Living in a scientific age, we need citizens who know enough about science to make intelligent decisions about what they do. We use science to prolong life, to increase security and happiness. But it can also be used for destruction. Are we going to use it constructively? It'll be up to you, and you too.
Hey, Todd.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
I'm really well.
Good.
Do you know who Leonard Stern was? Do you recognize that name?
Kind of. Oh, I'm thinking Ishtok Stern or whatever.
Ishtok the violinist. Stern, yes. No, Leonard Stern. He was the inventor of the Mad Libs, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
and it turns out he passed away. I was just reading through his obituary.
Were you now?
Yeah. And Leonard passed away last week in Malibu at the age of 88. In life, he loved to skateboard, cook, and he enjoyed jazz dancing. He survived by his nephew, Bill, and his daughter, Dawn. He will forever be remembered for his love of his three-toed sloths and farts.
Now, did he really die just recently or not?
He didn't die recently. Okay. Leonard Stern was a real man.
We went down that path for nothing.
Absolutely. Yeah. So he passed away in 2011.
Okay. Here's the funny, the ironic thing about Mad Libs is that they're almost never funny. But I guess they're funny to fill out, maybe.
Years, right.
And for, yeah, I guess if you're 12.
If you're 12. Even jokes.
When I was a kid, I remember it being, like, after you go through it, it being so unfulfilling when you finally read it.
So Nick loves Mad Libs. I'm completely safe of saying all this because he definitely doesn't listen to the show. So I know that he'll not hear this except maybe through somebody else.
Right.
But he's tried several times to engage me with Mad Libs on the road for road trips.
Oh,
and they're just boring to me at all. And I try.
Yeah.
Let's make this one clever.
Like the funnier you try to be, like the even worse they turn out.
It turns out, so he did a lot of other things besides Mad Libs. He was a writer on The Honeymooners, Get Smart, and Macmillan and Wife.
Oh, wow.
To name a few. But his most enduring contribution was filling in the blank spaces. He co-created the popular word game Mad Libs with fellow comedy writer Roger Price in 1958.
Wow.
Mad Libs.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Why are we on the freeway on?
It just seemed like a funny little quip.
Okay,
it,
well, it I have deep. I have the inaugural In the Wild Use of
nice.
That I was going to play after your dad joke that
Excellent.
You usually do at the front. But
awesome.
Well, I do have, we should introduce the show, I guess.
Sure.
This is the Mark and Todd cast.
Hi.
I am one of your hosts, Todd Workoven, and with me, as always, is Mark Middleton. How are you, Mark?
I'm very well today.
Good, good. I feel like we haven't done the show in a while, but I guess we did. I guess we did one just last week, but we had our 100th episode last week,
right.
Which was kind of out of the,
it was out of
the style
the
we do. So yeah, it seems
so
like we
haven't merged with the Not Nerds and it was great. I had a ton of fun with
Yeah, that was really fun. But I did in the last couple of weeks, I should get some music for this, for a documentary watch or whatever, but I watched a couple, really good documentaries. One of them I found because I'm using your Hulu account.
Of course.
And it was, recently watched and it's called Too Funny to Fail, which is
yes.
about the Dana Carvey sketch show that, were the first jobs for like Steve Carell and Stephen Colbert and, Louis C.K. and Robert Smigel and like all of these comedy titans working on this
right.
show that just imploded. And it is fascinating.
It is really fascinating. And I remember watching that show.
I specifically remember very first sketch. I remember when that came on, the one with President Clinton.
And it was just confusing
yeah.
to me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how I feel about this. And
yeah. This yeah, should be funny.
It should be funny, but
it's not.
Yeah. And so what happened during that President Clinton skit?
It was the very first sketch on the air for this new primetime Dana Carvey sketch show in the 90s. And the whole conceit was something like President Clinton was trying to look more nurturing or more approachable, nurturing, something like that. Yeah. So at the end of the sketch, he unbuttons his shirt and he has a bunch of teats, like a puppy, and starts feeding puppies on these like gross prosthetic
and babies.
Just, you know, gross nonsense. And
they squirted milk. Like his teats actually.
Yeah, it was aggressive. It was, and they say in the documentary, they're like, "This is the line that we're drawing, and you're either with us or against us." And most people were against it,
very against.
So, but it's fascinating, and to hear them talk about how they chose that sketch and like the fallout, they had real time ratings and watched like 20 million people just flee,
turn off their TVs,
and yes. It has the funniest moment, I think. I won't spoil it, but. That I've laughed was so hard when they were talking about the home improvement lead-in, and they showed the screen capture of the starting at 9 home improvement and then the Diet Mug root beer Dana Carvey show. Oh my gosh, I really laughed hard at them. So that's good. And there's another one called Dying Funny, which I think is on Hulu. It's either on Hulu or Netflix. I want to say Hulu, but it is. A bunch of very famous comedians all talking about the art of being a stand-up comic and what that means. And like, it's a very navel-gazing, like quote unquote unfunny, serious look at being it. But I love that stuff. And it's just all those people talking about what it's like to be on a road, what it's like to bomb in front of the audience for the first time, what it's like to be successful. And it's got just a million people in it. So like every stand-up that has made some noise in the last 30 years is in that. And
you know, I think fondly on the idea of I could do that.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
and then you know, somebody at work will say one, you know, thing that I interpret as kind of mean maybe, and I get all offended. It takes hours for me to get over it.
Yeah.
And I like it ruins my week, and it's just like, oh yeah, stand-up comedy isn't for me.
Yeah.
Because
one heckle and it's like over.
Right. You do poorly one night and I would rethink my everything and every choice that I've ever made. Right. Because
it's true though. Cause it's like the only job where someone comes up and is like, you suck.
Yeah. I was watching a Joan Rivers, in the mornings, especially on weekend mornings when Nick is sleeping, I get up early.
I love all of the conditions that you're applying on this thing that you haven't announced yet.
And so I will get deep into Reddit videos. And, just the stream of Reddit videos. And so you go 50, 60, you know, video clips deep.
Yeah.
And so one of the ones that I was watching this morning was Joan Rivers dealing with a heckler.
Oh, wow.
You know, and so she's talking about, you know, I wish my child was, I hate raising children. I would have loved having Helen Keller as a child because she didn't talk and wouldn't talk back and everything. And there's a heckler, like, that's not funny. You don't know what it's like to have a deaf child like I do. And she just goes off, you know, cusses at him and launches into him and you're stupid and here's why. And my father was deaf and, you know, just launches and just annihilates this guy.
Wow.
From the stage. And I also know that in those kind of situations of confronting somebody, I definitely come up with my best material a couple hours later.
Yeah.
And I just don't think on the fly that way like she did. And
it would rattle me because I've always thought that too. And it's like, nope.
I'll write software.
The only logical explanation. But yeah, Dying Funny is really good too. I did. Also, this is completely off topic. I did get something that I've kind of had my eye on since I knew they existed maybe about a year ago, and that is a weighted blanket.
Oh yeah, we've talked about that.
So we've talked about it a little bit before, and I had a little extra money come in, and I, of course, had to drive around to actual stores because I wasn't gonna buy that over the internet, and plus shipping would have cost a fortune, I suppose.
Amazon Prime.
I think I've looked before. I don't think any of the weighted blankets are Anyway, I wanted one now,
right, of course.
Not several days from now and the wrong thing. So I decided to go to Brickstone and I bought it, and it's a 15 pound and it's basically a really soft, cozy blanket that has some interior sections, I guess, in it that are just filled with what seems like sand. And it is wonderful. The only problem with it is that it's super hot.
Right.
And so both nights, I just put it on my regular comforter the first night, and I thought I was going to die. I woke up in the middle of the night just swimming in sweat, and it was just awful. So I'm hoping to figure out the formula for it not being too hot. But it is, they're really, really, really quite comfortable. They're not cheap, but they're, they are, and I think the slogan is something like, sleep in a hug or something like that, the one that I got, and I was like, yes, I will. So yeah, it's pretty great. I'm pretty happy with it so far. So
the best tagline I've heard of a company recently, I'm working on a website for the National Psoriasis Foundation. Okay. To which their tagline is, the P is silent, but we are not.
That is great.
I thought it was really
great. That is really great.
Like, yeah. And
good
so
for
they,
you.
They're the voice for psoriasis.
Psoriasis. Yeah. I always used to say it that way. Psoriasis. It's not a funny disease. It's a funny name for a disease.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get into, should we go to Brian the Unipiper before news or after news?
Let's call up the Unibiber.
All right.
Signal him and have him call us.
Yes, we'll put his light in the air and he will call in. After that, we'll do some news and then we'll talk about the deep dark web.
Yes. Hello, is this Brian the Unipiper?
Hey, Mark, it is.
Nice. You're coming through loud and clear.
Almost too loud, one would say.
Well, now I have to play the...
Well, now it's too loud.
Now it's too loud.
Now it's
all right, loud. We've got it figured out. Not your fault. It was our
fault. Our levels were a little off. How are you?
Doing well. Obviously not out making deliveries right now because you can hear me.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, technology sort of failed us last week in that attempt at a live call.
Yeah. We'll have to go back to the drawing board before we try that one again.
Yeah. Seriously, like a sound isolating microphone or something like that.
Or just fake it in the studio.
Yes, that's true.
Todd, how are you doing? Are you feeling better today?
I am still a little. Right before you called, I was Mark was having trouble pronouncing words, and I'm like, oh, this will be fun because I'm super foggy and my voice doesn't sound all that great either. But I'm a game day player, so I'm excited to be here.
And I'm just hoping that he's not too contagious.
I'm not. No, I'm after the 3 day, which I think is 2 days before and 3 days after you get sick is when you're contagious. Don't quote me on that. So I guess that's another thing I said. I said, we'll find out how contagious I am next week on the Mark and Todd Cast.
How many days work I missed over the next 5.
Well, it looks like you at least got a chance to catch up on your Stranger Things like the rest of America.
I did. Well, I've only watched the first episode, but I finally started it. Yeah. I figured I can't get too far behind because then I'll miss all the great memes that will be made from it. So.
Yeah, I can't wait for you to finish it because I have some things to say about it.
Awesome. I've heard it's just great, and it's more intense, and it's more, it's just, I've heard it's really good, so.
Yeah, Nick and I are like 2 or 3 episodes in.
Yeah.
Nick jumped an episode away from me, so
okay,
I don't know where he's at right now.
Have you finished it all, Brian?
I've got one episode left.
Okay.
Yeah. So once that's over and now that Halloween has passed us, like it really feels like there's nothing left to live for this year. I feel like there's just so much build up to Halloween this year. I don't know if it felt any different to you.
I think it's kind of like the pumpkin spice thing, how it's been gaining popularity over the last couple of years. And all of a sudden it's hitting critical mass that like everybody kind of collectively decided to be super into Halloween.
Yeah, and I also feel the same about Dia de los Muertos. The Day of the Dead is gaining in popularity, and to his credit, like Nick was really in on the early train on the Day of the Dead. He he and I went down to southern Mexico to like do a little research project back in 2007, 10 years ago.
Wow.
And nobody was talking about it, that, you know, very, very only, you know, Mexican communities in Los Angeles and stuff had any recognition of Day of the Dead.
What that was.
And now there's mainstream Pixar movies and right. Pixar movies and everything else. And yeah.
It's going to be the next big thing.
Now we all get to buckle down for the Christmas onslaught that we have every year. So yes. I always kind of just bury my head down and make it through January.
Well, Mark, speaking of Nick, I did happen to notice today that it is the very last day of Helen's rummage sale. Has Nick been yet?
Yes. Yeah. So Nick went and...
is this the costume place
again? Yeah, the costume place. Helen's
Costumery.
Yeah, up on Gleason. And so they have been selling off their inventory.
Right.
And so he got a couple discreet items, not any big... full costumes, but went through the place and got a couple hard to find items.
So just like that, 127 years of Portland history is no more today.
Wow. Yeah. Today, last day.
What's funny is when I was in there, they were telling folks like, because I was in there right at the beginning of the sale, and people were asking where they can go and stuff, and they were basically directing everyone to a place in Beaverton called the Halloween Warehouse.
Yes, but I thought that went out of business too.
Well, I just heard today that November 10th, they have now announced is going to be their last day.
Oh, maybe I had a premonition. Because there's out on like Highway 10 or whatever by that, across from the Fred Meyer that's out there. There was always a Halloween superstore, and maybe it was bought by the other place and changed buildings or something. But, well, that's a bummer.
Yeah, it's a total bummer. And I read an article interview with the owners, and they were blaming the economy. But that I don't buy that. You know,
I remember seeing that Halloween store, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, however long it was open, thinking, how on earth can a place stay in business year round selling costumes? And I guess we found out that apparently they can't
they
forever.
Can't.
Yes.
That's a bummer, though.
What's happening around Portland?
Well, so here's something, Todd, that I want you to check out because it's in your neck of the woods.
Oh, really?
So check this out and give us a report. Have you heard of something, speaking of Beaverton, called the Interactive Museum of Gaming and Puzzlery?
No.
So this is the nation's largest museum of board games and puzzles. That until very recently was in Beaverton, but now they have moved to King City, which is really close to you. Is that right?
Yeah, that's, Todd? I think, a little jog down the freeway, which as far as I think is just like a couple of rest stops right now. I mean, it's like on the way to all the outlet malls, I believe, like by Jervis or whatever that other place that you go out. Wow, that's doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't yet.
No.
Yeah, King City. I looked up King City on the map just so because I had never heard of it. But yeah, if you get off at there's Durham and Tualatin, you kind of go out towards if you take 99W.
Oh, you get off on 99. Oh yeah.
It goes right by King
City. Yeah, it's
City
right on the edge of Tigard. Okay,
exactly.
Yeah, by Bull Mountain.
Precisely.
Okay, I was getting that mixed up with some other place by Jervis. Apparently. Okay, I know where that is.
So this place looks amazing. They have, they claim they have 6,010 different games.
Wow.
And they have a library system where you can become a member and
check out games. Oh, nice. Wow. You know what that's next to is the Ham Radio Outlet, which I love that place still exists. And it's a huge store for the Ham Radio Outlet. And every time I go past it, it's that they're going to laugh when society crumbles and we're all crying at their front door asking for their ham radio technology again.
That's funny. So King City is becoming quite the...
Totally. I'm going to be house sitting, not in that area, but kind of out in Beaverton and that area this weekend. So I'm going to see if I can maybe go past it.
Yeah, it says they're open on from Wednesday to Sunday, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m.
Nice. Oh, that's cool. I'll go check that out.
Yeah. It's been a while since we talked. I don't think we've mentioned this yet, but pretty big news in Portland. The movie Madness Kickstarter.
Yeah.
I think we briefly mentioned it right as it started, the Kickstarter
right.
project.
It hadn't yet been fulfilled at the time that we talked about it last.
right? I think that might have even been on Portland at the movies.
Yeah, probably.
But so it took them, I think, 4 days to reach their goal.
Wow.
And at the time of launch, it became the fourth most popular project on Kickstarter.
Wow.
Which is just crazy.
Wow.
So now that they're at $280,000 of their original $250,000 project. So Movie Madness will be saved and purchased by the Hollywood Theater and continue to operate. But they've got just about 10 days left to go to get to $350,000, which would be super cool because they would add a screening room and you could be able to rent private, host private events there and host private screenings.
That would be perfect for, speaking of, Portland at the movies.
I know. So, you know, I feel like the buzz has kind of died off. So I've been trying to spread the word that, you know, it's there, but this would is a chance for some,
make
and they're
it
talking
even
about
better.
Adding pizza and a bar and things. That would just be really neat.
Now, would they do it at the where? What location would they do that at?
That was my question.
Not
yeah.
to
pick at a Movie Madness at the current location.
Got
oh,
it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Huh.
Has there ever been talk about bringing Movie Madness into or next to the Hollywood Theater or like integrating the two more?
I wonder if there's just not enough room there.
Yeah.
There hasn't been direct talk that I've heard of, but I think some of the language in the project on the Kickstarter has been vague enough to where, you know, they say they want to keep it at the present location for now. So, you know, maybe that would be a long-term goal.
Right.
Yeah.
That would, yeah, a combined building would be really, really neat.
It would. So there's an example of a Portland Kickstarter success story. The opposite end of the spectrum. I'm sad to report, Todd. I know this was something that was on your radar.
Oh, no.
But the Die Hard the musical.
Oh, that's right.
It does not look like it's going to reach its goal.
That's a bummer.
Yeah, they've got just 3 days to go, and they are only at $1,200 of their $6,000 goal.
Wow. Well, maybe the Mark and Todd cast bump for those last 2 days after the show is posted will get the job done.
All right, so. Fan, get out there.
If the one
these are the folks who brought us the Buffy the Vampire Slayer the musical and Reservoir Dogs the musical. Neither of which I'm sad to say I did not see.
Yes, I did not catch any of those. I do know that there's a really awesome Night of the Living Dead that they do. I don't know if it's a musical, but it's a stage show that's done in black and white.
Ooh.
And so all of they're all painted up to look like black. And that's, and I don't know when the last time they've done it. I know 10 years ago or so they were doing it, and I think it caught on. But it was just such a neat concept of having a black and white live stage show.
That is neat. I just went to the Hollywood Theater to see Night of the Living Dead on Halloween.
Oh, nice.
And it really holds up. It's a great movie.
Were there a lot of people there?
It was about, I'd say the theater was half full.
Okay, that's not too bad.
And of those, of the people there, probably half of them were in costume.
Oh, fun.
It was.
Nice.
Let's see. Lastly, I just want to throw in underwater hockey is a thing that exists here in Portland.
What?
That's yeah. Opposite polo.
Yeah, I'm just going to throw that out there. Look it up if you're interested. They meet at Mount Hood Community College. There's something for everyone, and if your thing is underwater hockey, you can feel at home.
Underwater.
November
hockey.
7th is their next game. That's in 2 days.
I'm trying to find pictures here. Appears that people have, like, they're not in scuba gear. They're in snorkels and masks and fins. It looks like they're all holding the thing that scrapes ice off of your windshield in the winter, that little thing that you hold in your hand, and they're all just at the bottom of the tank pushing around a puck.
Yeah, it's like a 6-pound puck or something, so it stays on the bottom, and then I think they break up into, like, pairs. So somebody watches the person below, and they look for the signal that they're about to run out of oxygen, and then they get tagged out, and then the next person goes down, and they try and push this puck all along the bottom of the swimming pool.
Why are they doing this?
Underwater hockey is played in a swimming pool by two teams of up to 10 players each. The puck is made of lead with a brightly covered plastic coating. Players use a short stick to push, pull, and pass the puck in an attempt to get it into the opposing team's goal located at the end of the pool.
But at least in hockey, the puck slides. A hunk of lead is going nowhere when you're pushing it with an ice scraper.
It's going to be opposite of hockey.
Underwater hockey is a fast-paced, fun-filled sport for athletes of all ages. Unlike its on-ice counterpart, underwater hockey is a non-contact sport. While some jostling and bumping may occur, especially in competitive play, contact is generally not allowed and focuses on fitness, teamwork, and finesse.
Wow, that would be really hard to communicate with your teammates underwater like that.
Yeah.
Body language.
I'm going to use this crazy illustration for the show.
I'm open.
That's the dumbest joke. So you did have...
But we both came up with it at the same time.
Exactly. The Mark and Talk cast. Brian, I did see, and I don't know, maybe you don't want to talk about it, I can cut it out later. I did see you posted an event to your Facebook page this afternoon.
Yes, and that's what I was going to end with.
Oh, okay, good.
To let folks know, to come out this week, Thursday evening, the Unipiper and Mosho the Cat Rapper are going to be featured guest storytellers at the Siren Theater in Portland, and it's going to they're having an improv comedy and storytelling night. So yeah, that'll be featuring the Unipiper and Mosho.
So how does that work? You're just going to go tell a story, or like the story of how you became the Unipiper, or do you know what you're going to do yet? Like,
no,
what is the what are the parameters?
I need to figure that out. So yeah, folks probably know my good friend, Mosho, the Cat Rapper. He was invited to, I think it's kind of like the Moth, you know, where people get up and tell a live personal story.
Okay.
So, Mosho invited me to come along and also tell a story, and I thought it sounded like a fun opportunity. And I am going to say something about life as the Unipiper. I don't know what yet.
But, well, I'm sure, and long-time listeners to our show know that we had an experience with a professional storyteller who came in for Nicholas's Mark's partner Nick's birthday, and he was the worst thing we have all experienced. So I think you are on track for being the new storyteller of the year.
He was also the 2016. Right. He was also the 2016 storyteller of Washington.
And after we had suffered through it and like just sat each other agog that this man had a career, we found out later he was awarded the storyteller of the year in Washington State. So yeah, that's there you go, a new revenue stream for the Unipiper.
Yep, and this is actually the second storytelling event that I've been invited to this year. I did not respond to the first invite I got. It was for a sexy and intimate storytelling opportunity.
<Ew. laughs> That's what people want out of the Unipiper, is sexy and intimate.
Yeah, I just felt like I didn't have the right material. And I didn't know how I would get around the inevitable pipes jokes.
Or the what's under your kilt, all of those things.
See how this goes, maybe next time.
That's amazing. Well, if people wanted to find out more about the Unipiper, what can they do?
Check me out on Facebook. You can check out the event that I just added and see ticket information. And yeah, come out Thursday and say hi to the Unipiper and Mosho the Cat Rapper.
Awesome. We will talk to you later, Ryan.
Very cool.
Great. See you guys.
Bye. So I've been watching a couple of videos since Brian was talking about underwater hockey, and talk about the least. There's like two sports in the world that are the least friendly for watchers, for bystanders to like. This is not skydiving isn't a spectator sport. And underwater hockey, not a spectator sport. I was just looking at videos of like, there's a pool with people underneath the water.
Sometimes at the Super Bowl or the like the Olympics, they'll do the skydivers that have the trail of smoke.
Yes.
And they'll spin down into and land in the stadium. That's as close as you get those to spectator sport for.
Totally. So there's a component of skydiving called relative work that is. Once they jump out of the plane, they 2, 3, 4, 5 people will go in formations and create little arrangements,
right. Yeah,
and it's fascinating. It's really hard to do. It's incredible. Like, and it's absolutely unwatchable except by a videographer
with the group. When they're like, the world's largest hexagon made of people parachuting.
Exactly. Like a 4-person team, they'll do crazy configurations and reshape and do things in real time. And it's very, very, very impressive to watch, but you can't watch it as a live spectator at all. It's just impossible.
At the air show. And there's...
Exactly. Like, oh, that's useless.
All right. Well, let's do some news here.
Beep, 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 beep.
There was a couple. Let's see. Where do I want to start? Oh, we have a, I'm going to start and I think end with a charming story here. So the first one is that a beluga whale learns to speak dolphin after moving in with a pod. According to Discovery Magazine, one beluga started speaking dolphin after she moved into a tank with no other animals but bottlenose dolphins. The 4-year-old captive animal had grown up around other beluga whales, but moved in 2013 and was somewhere where she had no other belugas to talk to. However, both animals, the beluga and the dolphins, make whistling noise, and they're sort of related, but they're audibly very different. 2 months after making the switch, she made up new whistles and vowels, this article says. And she whistled like a dolphin and even imitated the signature whistles that individual dolphins in her group made. So the story isn't very fascinating, but I kept it around for this next sentence because it amused me. Belugas are sometimes called sea canaries because of how they sing, which I don't think is true. Like, maybe it is. But sea canaries cracked me up.
I was watching a video about whales and the clicking noises that they, it might've been in the same stream of Reddit videos that I was watching, the clicks of, certain whales. I think it might've been beluga whales or, maybe sperm whales. The clicks are so powerful. They can be heard thousands of miles away. They surmise that, whales on the other side of the planet can actually communicate through these clicks.
Wow.
Divers in the water with these whales can be killed by the force of the clicks through their body. It basically liquefies their organs. And there was a case in this video of a diver in the water, and the whale was approaching him, and he held his hand out to... to keep it from bumping into him, basically.
Yeah.
It clicked and paralyzed his hand for 6 hours.
Oh, my God.
It just went
numb. Well, it's like that mantis shrimp, too, that it cocks its claws or whatever, and it can knock people out with a sonic boom.
Like, what
the
is
ocean
going
is
on?
Terrifying. It's legit.
Like, it's like Australia underwater.
But this beluga, known as a sea canary... developed all these new noises and gave up speaking beluga in the absence of the other one. So it shows that it was adapted for actual communication help instead of just playful kind of mimicking.
Huh.
So that was pretty interesting. So there was two massive releases of data from the government this last week. One of them I kind of looked into, which was all of the Kennedy assassination papers.
Yeah.
Did you look into any of that at all?
Not personally.
I did the worst thing you could do, which is I clicked on the Facebook news link or whatever that just showed all of the different things that were coming up. So it was like from a bunch of different websites, and half the people were like rending their clothing that it was lies, and they had proof that Oswald was doing this, and it was just nonsense. So I stopped looking into it.
There was a Reddit thread that said, what's the most surprising thing that you've learned from the JFK papers? And so it had people respond with things that they, with references of things that they've read through and found in the papers. And the most surprising to me as reading through those, I don't know her name, but there was a lady who was a celebritant at the time that was involved, and she ended up committing
suicide.
At the time of the assassination.
Okay.
She ended up committing suicide with you know, at very suspicious circumstances and everything. And she had, she was on one of those panel shows in the 50s and 60s of like kind of a What's My Line or, okay, or one, yeah, of those. Yeah. And there were
whatever that show was that John and Yoko showed up in bags.
Exactly. And there were some really suspicious things. She called a friend and left a message about, or like called a friend, we have to meet about this thing. And then like she disappeared and it's always been kind of swept under the rug. And there's a big section under the JFK papers.
So this is
her.
A legit sounding.
It's a legitimate.
Okay. So it's not like, yeah,
but there's not any resolution,
right,
with it. You just learn more of the holes in
it,
the
just
story.
Ask more, yeah, questions.
It does.
Open
it
your mind, man.
Sheeple.
Stop believing what they're feeding you.
Exactly.
But there was also a massive government report that said climate is warming and humans are the cause. So it is, quote, extremely likely that human activities are the dominant cause of global warming, according to the most comprehensive study ever of climate science by U.S. government researchers. The climate report notes that the past 115 years are, quote, the warmest in the history of modern civilization. The global temperature has increased by about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit over that last 115 years, mostly due from greenhouse gases from industry and agriculture. So it was a 600-page report. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association was involved, NASA, and the Department of Energy, as well as academic science. So you can find out a lot more. There was obviously some very long articles about that, but I kept that short because I found another kind of related story. Since the weather is going crazy, the city of Winnipeg changed all of their stoplights to LEDs, which of course are not hot enough to melt the snow that collects on the outside of it. So traffic signal lights at some intersections throughout the city have become partially obscured by snow and snow frozen to the lens, said Winnipeg manager of corporate communications David Dreiger. Quote, over the years, the city has replaced traffic signal bulbs with LED lights, which are not as hot and do not melt the snow. They said the weather conditions resulted in crashes involving 97 vehicles at 15 different locations across the city. So
maybe they can make like a little coal heater or something that wraps around the signals so that
tiny lanterns close to keep the LEDs nice and
just
warm,
fueled by whale blubber and and coal. Clean coal.
Yes, clean coal is the future. All right, here's a story that's going to hit home to you, Mark.
Oh my gosh.
Bitcoin skyrockets, Mark.
I know.
$7,000, above $7,000 for the first time, and more than sevenfold increase in value since the start of this year. So it has seen huge gains in recent months and more than doubled in value in this last 7 weeks alone.
So we've talked about this a dozen times, but in 2011, when Bitcoins were many Bitcoins for a dollar, I started the process of setting up a wallet, but it was too complex and I was working and things. I just never finished it.
Yeah.
There were websites that you could sign up for. You gave them your email address, created an account. They just gave you 3 Bitcoins. Just 3. And so that would be $21,000 today. A year and a half ago, you and I had a Bitcoin
episode.
We bought $40 worth of Bitcoin. And today, those would be worth about $490. I don't have them anymore because I've been using them to pay for our
equipment and stuff.
Everything.
Yeah.
Just an online account for the private network, the VPN.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So we can download things, and so we don't have those. And just over and over, I have a friend that I know through another friend. He's an acquaintance of mine. He's a good friend of a friend of mine, and he's like, I have $3 million now. that I didn't have before.
My gosh.
Because he had like a dozen Bitcoins or whatever, you know, and he has $3 million. He's like 25. And he's like, I think I'm going to buy my apartment building. And I'm just like,
Bitcoin problems. That is crazy.
There was a person who bought a pizza with 10,000 Bitcoins back in 2010 or 2011. 10,000 Bitcoins, you know, 10,000 times 7,000 is $70 million. $70 million.
So here was my question, and I kind of asked you this a while ago, but
should we buy more?
Should we buy? Are we bullish on Bitcoin? No. So if it's what, $7,000 now for one Bitcoin, is that the deal?
Yep.
So as Bitcoins continue to develop or go up or whatever, how, like, I get how the stock market works that way, but if they're treating Bitcoin as money, correct? Not,
yep, it's a
not
currency.
A stock or a bond. It is
right.
A currency.
Right.
So how can you have a currency that is prohibitive for people who are not rich to acquire? Does that make sense?
No.
Well, like, say me, for example, who cannot afford $7,000 for one piece of currency. Like, how, at the beginning, aren't you structuring a currency that leaves out anyone? Like, currency should be attainable by everyone, yes?
Yes.
I mean, that's
but
the point
still,
of it.
Right.
It's,
and, but it was structured very, very specifically to...
So does it split like stocks do, or does it become more affordable at some point?
No.
Or you're just like, you
no, it becomes
miss
less,
the train.
Yeah, it was very specifically designed to be more and more difficult to acquire Bitcoins as they were created. And
right.
So down the road, they become scarcer, and so they develop value. And so it's an algorithm. And...
But that's
and
not
supply
how
supply and demand. You
it
know.
Doesn't seem like that's how currency works.
Well, it up until Nixon divested the dollar and all the conspiracies around this gold and everything. It used to be where every dollar had the equivalent of a dollar of gold in Fort Knox.
Yeah,
and that's no longer the case. And so now we have a whole different philosophy about how currencies work. But back in the day, it was very much there is a set number of dollars based on the gold that the United States owns. And if you want to make more dollars, you have to get more gold.
Right.
And that was it. And because of that, once those were separated, now you could just pump more dollars into the system to deflate what a single dollar
right.
is equivalent to, then it shifted the whole equation.
Right. I mean, I guess it just seems to me, economics wizard Todd Workhoven, that a system needs
you
a way.
You have written a book that has the word economics in the title. And I'm looking at it right. It's right
touché,
behind your head.
Touche. That was a pre-Bitcoin world, I guess. But if it doesn't sound like there's a way for the system to correct itself, like it seems like, and isn't that how systems that survive need to be set up, that there's a...
Well...
Because else it's just a system for rich people to get richer, correct?
Well, or people with more Bitcoins to get richer.
Right.
Which, incidentally, weren't rich people initially.
But couldn't there be a failure at the exchange level? Like when
I think
people
so.
Are would just yeah. be like, no, this is ridiculous.
Yes, absolutely. And so that's
how it corrects itself.
Right.
Okay.
Is people don't want to use Bitcoins to sell things or to buy things anymore.
So
we'll
let's say no. Let's say all of a sudden people stop buying Bitcoins because they're like
right.
$7,000 is ridiculous.
Right.
Does that make, if
now,
it's just
the
an,
price per Bitcoin would crash.
Right.
Which
but,
it did like 5 years, 3 years ago.
And the algorithms that sets that triggers that, or is there a, what is in charge of that? Like it's not
well,
the Federal Reserve
there's only
that's setting
a
that. That's
set
a,
number of Bitcoins in the world right now.
Right.
And so if people said they, if people's purchasing process shifted where they weren't using them anymore. And in order to sell my goods, I required you to spend more bitcoins okay. on them, which would lower the value per bitcoin. Sure. It's a marketplace that sets the value of the bitcoin, not not the quantity of bitcoins out there. So right. the algorithm sets how many are out there. The blockchain system of getting bitcoins into the world, and now there's a set number out there. Then the market decides what the value of that is.
Right. That's so. That was your Bitcoin talk for.
It was.
Doesn't make sense to me, I guess. And the robots will have our old jobs anyway, so I guess we're gonna have to figure out how to mine Bitcoin on our own. Yes. Well, I do have one last heartwarming story, and that is dishwashers on the rampage. LG's Internet of Things security bug highlights the risk of home automation. So this last week, a security vulnerability within LG's technology for automating communication within its home appliance devices. They were able to, what are they able to do here? They were able to introduce something to just show that there was a security flaw and new methods of attacking other smart devices that are all connected to that big network that we're all building around our lives, that Internet of Things thing. So weakness in the core software allowed an attacker to create a fake LG account, then use this to take over the account of a legitimate user that would provide access to all of their appliances, which I love because it seems like every movie in the 80s, there was at some point where like in Gremlins, where like everything in the house was going crazy and the dishwasher's spitting out foam and the microwave's doing something. And I just imagine walking in the house to that, dishes flying everywhere. But it also presents security concerns for things like remote cameras, which says remote cameras on automated vacuums. Which
remote cameras
are vacuums automated, needing to like look at the floor that they're vacuuming?
I think Roombas, you know, or robotic
ones, to sense where the wall is, maybe.
Right. Or you know, get back to home.
So
and
yeah, those
like that.
Those cameras could be targeted. I'm sure they wouldn't be able to find out a whole lot that way, but it's just to show everything from your home video cameras or your security systems, all of that stuff. Once it's all tied together, they are. Susceptible to attacks and software overtakes. So do be careful when setting up your smart refrigerator and smart dishwasher. So anyway, that's all the news I had this nice. Week.
Well, what I thought we would talk about today is something that's come up a couple times, which is the deep web and dark web. And to get to there, I thought we'd also just set some foundational information about the internet and the surface web and of what is the internet.
Okay.
Yeah, so Todd, what's the difference between the internet,
do I need my joke thing,
and the web?
I don't know.
So they are.
Oh, is this like this is
no? They're okay. Different.
I was getting ready for the. But no, that's not one of those situations.
No, this is legitimate. So the
internet and the web.
Yeah.
Boy, I don't know that I would. I mean, I'm sure I can bullshit something, but
yeah.
I don't know that.
Yeah,
I would.
Yeah. So generally, we use them interchangeably.
Right.
Like I'm going to go on the internet to find. I'm going to go on the web and find. They are different. So the internet is the network of computers around the world. And those computers have interconnecting information between them so that they can exchange files and information between them. The web or the World Wide Web, what we surf the web is it's a way of accessing information over the medium of the internet.
Okay.
And so it's an information sharing model that's built on top of the internet. And the web uses specifically, it uses HTTP protocol or hypertext transfer protocol, which is the mechanism that browsers use to exchange HTML and images and JavaScript and those kind of things. So when you use a web browser, you are browsing the World Wide Web using the underlying technology of the internet.
Okay.
Make sense? So when we are going about our daily lives on the web, we are generally engaging in what people refer to as the surface web or the visible web. And the surface web is whatever a search engine is able to find. And okay. So if you go to the Drudge Report and you click on links and read information deep into, you know, you go click on a link that brings you into a category, and then you browse that category and you click on an article and that brings you to the detail of that article. That's all surface web, because you haven't, Google has that same information. Google sends a spider out, which is a program that does that same activity. It loads up Drudge Report.
Like a web crawler?
A web crawler is another word for a spider or a crawler. And it will pull up the Drudge Report. It will look for links on that page, and it will follow those links to the next document and gather that document. And so currently, as of about a year ago, the estimate that Google had on one of their pages was that they had 60 trillion web pages indexed. Wow. 60 trillion web pages indexed. That accounts for a tiny fraction of what's actually out on the web. And not just nefarious kind of information that's under the hood, but what we refer to as the deep web is anything that Google doesn't have access to because it's not on the surface and isn't indexed, and so you can't readily find it or index it. And an example would be if you went to Expedia.com and you wanted to find a flight between Portland and Sydney, you would perform a search given your specific criteria and your the time frame that you're looking for, the number of passengers that you're looking for, and the result page is a category listing or a listing of all of the available flights that match your criteria. That page is not indexed by Google because you had to perform actions to customize and get the results of that specific page. So you wouldn't be able to perform that same action on Google and have Google find it. So it's not an indexed page. It's a page that is very custom to your circumstance. Right.
Or like situation. When I upload one of the shows that I'm doing it in the admin page that I can get to, but precisely. It's not accessible to.
Exactly. So anything behind a password, that's considered deep web.
Ooh, okay.
Anything that is dynamic content like the Expedia page results, or I go to Amazon and look up, heavy blanket for dog in Vancouver, Washington, those kind of things that Google hasn't searched and indexed that specific result is still considered part of the deep web because it's not part of the Google index, if you will.
Okay.
And Google can't find it because it requires you
doesn't
to
exist yet. It doesn't exist yet. It's Schrodinger's link.
Exactly. There's also content that it's been excluded by what's called the robot exclusion standard. And so there's a robot exclusion standard on
which
the web.
Which is terrifying sounding.
It's terrifying, but it's actually very simple. You can go to websites, and after the website URL, you type in robots.txt. So I don't know if we've done that on the Market Podcast website, but we should
so
have.
So do what? Go to a website or any... I mean, don't go to our website.
Yeah, no, go to markandtodcast.com slash robots.txt.
Robots.txt.
And sure enough, I did do my job.
Disallow.
So it says user agent with an asterisk, and then it says disallow wp-admin and allow wp-admin slash admin-ajax.php, right? So what this is doing is it's giving specific instruction to Googlebots and other search engine robots and saying, hey, if the...
Hey man.
For user agents, allow everything. Using the asterisk says, any user agent is allowed, which means all robots, all spiders, all
ludicrous
mobile devices. Okay, so there's examples.
All
here.
Dementors. You know,
all Dementors.
All lizard men.
So if I didn't want the Googlebot to crawl my website, I would tell it here, disallow the Googlebot. And there's specific a user agent that the Googlebot abides to and says, hey, I'm the Googlebot. Am I allowed here or not? And you can specify, say, hey, no, don't index our site. You know, keep it out of your search engine, which would be ridiculous.
Now, is
for
there...
For our content.
Right. Is there...
It's a game of trust.
And I was going to say, is there anything other than we're relying on the niceness of the Google robot to do as we ask?
And so
that seems like a path to...
This is extraordinarily helpful in some cases. And one example would be we have websites that have a tremendous number of products in their inventory. So like 25,000, 125,000, 500,000 products, like in fabric companies or something where they just got tens of thousands of products. Uh-huh. When Facebook also has spiders and crawlers and so Facebook goes and indexes your website. When a bot comes to your website, it is loading that page and it loads it. It has an inherent weight that it incurs on your server because it's asking for this page. It renders that HTML and it pulls up that data and it accesses the database and it does work for that. So if I update something on my website that says, hey, Facebook, you need to re-index my product catalog. Now, all of a sudden, Facebook will pound on our website with 250,000 requests to get all of the 250,000 pages of data. And so you can say, hey, only
man.
Allow one request every 10 seconds or something like that. And you can, there's a whole bunch of robots.txt, things that you can do. And so we're telling the spiders how to deal with our website. It's not a security thing as much.
We are praying that there is no revolution.
Precisely. And so that's the robot standard. And then also items that have no incoming links. So sometimes a website will make a landing page that you can't link to from anywhere else on the website. And so Google can't find it because it just lives as an orphan. So an example of this would be if we went on the Portland of the Movies website, we have a map that you have been working on.
Yeah.
And so the portlandofthemovies.com/map is a
nice plug.
Nice is a standalone page. We have links that go into that. But if we removed those links, that page would stand alone with no incoming links to it. But if we told people about it, then people could type in that address directly. And go there. But Google wouldn't know that that page exists because there would be no links to it in that scenario. And so that would also be considered deep web stuff because you have to have a person, a human, finding and performing an action to get it into the browser. And so those are kind of the four categories, stuff behind passwords, dynamic content, robot exclusion stuff, and items that have no incoming links. Those are the kind of the four categories of deep web.
Okay. Right?
And so the deep web is
under the hood.
And estimates are about 500 times as much content is in the deep web as in the surface web.
Jeez.
And because if you think about like everything on your Facebook feed is really deep web content,
right?
Because you have to have a password and Google isn't indexing your feed. And
right.
Every time you load it, it's unique. And so all of that content is is specifically considered deep web content. And so you think of it like, oh, well, that's where I spend a good chunk of my day on the web is deep web content. And none of this is nefarious. It's not illegal. It's right. just not indexed by Google. And so it's not able to be automatically accessed and part of that indexable content sure. On the web.
Huh.
So the dark web. So the nice. Well played.
Well, that's long.
It was very long. So the dark web is a small portion of the deep web.
Says the PR hack for the dark web.
That is, it's encrypted and obfuscated and requires encryption and other routes to get into that that keep it from access, from normal access. And there's a process or a technology or a protocol called onion routing, or if you're from Great Britain, it's like onion routing was
really
yeah there was onion router. You might want to go back in our archives and re-listen to the encryption episode that we did a couple years ago. It's
I'll find it here.
So we have an episode where we talked about the process of encryption, especially with information over the internet. And encryption requires the source and the destination to agree on an encryption method and an encryption key. And then we exchange that key. And now that we both have that key, I can scramble information and lock it with that key, send it over a pipe to you, and you unlock it with the key that we have exchanged prior to that. And the result is if somebody tampers with the data in the middle, then they only get encrypted, useless gibberish instead of complete information.
Right.
But that protocol has an inherent problem in that, or an insecure problem in that we know the source and the destination for that transaction. So if somebody got that data in the middle, they would know that it came from Mark Middleton and went to Todd Workoven, but it's gibberish.
Okay.
Right? So if somebody is buying and selling drugs on the internet, or the methodology was actually invented in the late 70s as a technology to be used in naval armadas of sharing information between all of the ships in a community. And one of the inherent problems was they could figure out where the information was coming from and going to. And so based on that, they could infer that one ship was the key ship of the armada. And they knew that because all of the information was centrally coming to and from this one key ship, they knew that that was the most important ship and sure. that should be their target.
Interesting.
And so they wanted to obfuscate or extract that piece of information and make it unknowable of where the data came from and where it's going to, and keep it encrypted.
Right.
So they created onion routing. And onion routing layers encryption over the data like layers of an onion. So I have information that I want to get from my bank. Instead of, we know it's coming from Mark Middleton and going to Bank of America and vice versa, or USAA. Let's use USAA because that's my real bank. And
I think that's the opposite of how you're supposed to do things is,
but
is not,
I like
clarify.
USAA. I like USAA more than USAA or I like USAA more than Bank of America. And so I wanted to give them a plug. So USAA, instead So I'm here. The USAA headquarters is in Texas. There's a network of computers between us and Texas that the data is transmitted across. And in onion routing, in standard routing, we would know the source and the destination. Yeah. And anywhere along the road, you go, oh, that came from Mark Middleton. It's going to USAA. We don't know the exact information, but we know who it came from and where it's going to. And in the naval situation, we know that that's a bad situation. Uh-huh. So how do we keep the source and destination free from the intermediate hackers? What we do is we say, the only information that we create a network of nodes between here and Texas, it's encrypted initially with one layer of encryption, and the only information that is not obfuscated, is not encrypted, is the fact that it needs to go to this node B. And then once it's at node B, node B, the only information that it knows is it came from A and it's going to C. And so the individual packet of information only knows the only information that's available at that point in time is exactly the last step that it took.
Okay.
And the next step that it took.
Okay.
But it doesn't know where it started and where it's going. And so most of the onion routing happens in like 700 steps.
Wow.
And so it's entirely impossible to,
because at one point, if you're at point 600, it only knows about point 599 and 601.
Precisely. And so getting that information from that 600 node is absolutely useless. You right. have no idea where it came from. You have no idea where it's going to.
Or what,
and
what
it's
it says.
Encrypted. It's there's no idea about that, what that thing is already.
Uh-huh.
And 599 and 601 have another layer of encryption that they are each adding or removing, depending on which direction it's going. Uh-huh. It's unlocking or locking. And so it takes this encrypted ball and then adds, it re-encrypts it and adds another layer of encryption so that
each level is new encryption.
Each level is new and encrypted.
Jeez.
And so it's incredibly strong in encryption standards. People will argue about, there's like one pseudo technology that they can use to try and get a little bit of information, but it's so obscure, and it has to do with basically time stamping both sides of the equation, and you can kind of glean a little bit of information, but you're not really getting it.
Right.
You have to have way much more knowledge about the network than any individual hacker would have.
Right.
And it's just not a reliable way of hacking that kind of information.
Right.
And so the onion router, TOR, is the...
Wait, what?
The onion router is a...
Oh.
The so oh, onion
okay.
routing
TOR stands for the onion router.
Router.
Okay,
T-O-R.
I thought you were trying to respell router.
No,
somehow.
TOR, the onion router, or the is the mechanism that we use to access the dark web. And so the dark web is this encrypted school and encrypted technology that you can use to access more nefarious things or hyper encrypted things.
I was going to say, so is this what our banks operate on?
It's not. It's
because I was going to say, why name it all dark unless it's
right.
nefarious?
So, so I downloaded the Onion browser or the Tor browser.
So doesn't that put you on a list of some sort?
So,
like it's like putting up a sign in your front yard that you're, I don't know,
I mean,
looking for drugs or something like that.
Probably. I used our VPN, so it didn't matter. But so I can use the Tor browser and go to bankofamerica.com and do my banking on Bank of America. And I have added another layer of encryption to the process.
Okay.
Because although my banking information is highly encrypted in going back and forth with BofA.com, there still could be, this came from Mark Middleton and is going to BofA. And if I was concerned about that, I could use the Tor browser to do the same thing, and nobody in the man of the middle attacks can see find that. Find out that information.
Okay.
It's a little bit slower because the hops happen with more layers of encryption and some.
But anyone can download this.
Yep.
I mean, you don't need a.
Nope. You can just download it and install it.
That's the part that I don't know. That makes me even more uneasy than the idea of a dark web, that you just need like a different version of Firefox for it.
Exactly. And once you are on that. And
so listen up, kids.
Listen up, kids. Accessing information that's in doing this, you are able to browse the web truly anonymously. And a lot of websites will prevent you from doing that.
Right.
And so there's checks that websites can do. So I pulled up bofa.com and it works. USAA.com does not work.
Huh.
And so USAA doesn't allow you to access their website.
So do you think that's Tor. In prevention of some sort of hack or some sort of unknown?
Because they're a banking service, they need that traceability to find out that you are
the person you say
are the person you say you are, and not some nefarious activity. Because
right.
I don't have a BofA account, I can't log in, so
I
can't test that it truly does work all the way through.
Right.
But I can pull up the website and it's right here.
But I can slander their name all
I want. Totally. But the USAA gives an error. It doesn't say you're not doing the right thing. It just gives an error.
Okay.
And so it's prevented Tor browsing. On things. And so onion routing differs from other anonymity services in three ways. So communication is real time and bidirectional. So a lot of tools used to hide your information are not bidirectional. That you are able to upload something securely or something, but you're not able to download necessarily or whatever, but it's real time. It's bidirectional. The anonymous connections are application independent. So you can browse the web, but Tor, the technology, can be used for any transmission of data. So you could watch a video streaming across the web using a Tor, technology, and that video. The source and destination of that video would be hidden and encrypted in the process.
Okay.
And there's no centralized trusted component. So there's not a Tor office that is managing keys or generated. It is a protocol and a technology that's not centralized. So if I had a website, I can just put up a website and there's onion links that are .onion instead of .com. And that triggers this process of onion routing through your Tor browser. So I can go to a standard website.
This sounds
website.
Like those things where they're giving away free boats and like it's all of the people that have warrants out for their arrests. Right,
precisely. Or, the tax system doesn't exist and, it was never in our Constitution.
Yeah. it's where all the libertarians
go ahead. Yeah, go ahead and don't pay your taxes and see what happens. I had a roommate for a while that was
really, oh, really?
That was crazy. Spud was his name. He was awesome.
My dog's name was Spud.
Spud. And so I loaded up the Tor browser and surfed around. There's been a couple really big websites over the last few years that have that were dark web marketplaces. You could buy any drugs or firearms or anything. And the three big ones have been closed down with tons of people being arrested because they put in information. But and one was
it seems like there should be some barrier to entry, or it's like handing out the directions to like a literal black market where you could just like go buy illegal things.
Yeah, there's not. Yeah,
I guess that's both great and terrible. I mean, right. that's the internet.
It's the great leveler. And yeah.
Wow, interesting. Yeah. So now you are on a watch list.
And now I'm on a watch list.
And this is
more
our last
than
show.
I was before.
People will be crashing through the windows any moment.
Yeah. So
interesting. Yeah, because I always hear about this thing, and there's, I feel like there's a Showtime. There, like years ago, there was some sort of like 6-episode Showtime thing that I really wanted to be good about the dark web, and it wasn't, and so I was all mad. So thank you for filling in the gaps.
I'm here for you.
And if you are interested in listening to the encryption episode, it was number 19, called 100 Million Years of Encryption. So, well, that wraps us up then, I think, for another episode of the Mark and Toddcast. We might have some new listeners because we are now on the Fun Employment Radio Network for our 101st show. So if you are interested in seeing all the other things we talked about, and every week it's completely random, so if you do not like technology or anything, just wait till next week where we will talk about something completely, completely disparate and but still completely interesting. So we've got 100 episodes that you can look back. You can get it in your favorite podcast app, or you can go to markandtoddcast.com and get all of those episodes for free. What else do we have? Do we have anything else to?
I think that's
to
it.
Do what kind of music should we take us out with? Should we do? Is there anything go with? I'm terrified to even type in deep web. I'll type that into and then music.
It's a series of tubes.
Well, I guess I'll just. Oh, I don't. This was not the right thing to just type into.
Now you've got a virus.
I know. Now my computer has cancer. Thank you for listening. Let us know if you want to hear us talk about a subject that we haven't covered already. Follow us on Facebook and such. I promise I'm not sick and foggy headed every week, just this week. So thanks for enduring that. We will talk to you guys later.
All right. Ciao.